activity, everything.
Jane, we gotta change things up first.
Good morning, colleagues, members of the public. Welcome to this Friday, March 22nd, 2013 meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Today is, again, Governance Day, and we're going to, a little later on, we're going to have a work session to adopt the amendments to House Bill 3120. They are ready. This is, as you'll recall, the gut and stuff that replaces the placeholder bill with the actual language of that bill. But before we do that, we're going to talk some more about university governance in general, and we have some visitors here to talk to us. The real focus today is on academic programs and the the issue of maintaining a coordinated academic system for universities, and we'll be talking about statewide programs as well as just the extent to which the system is currently coordinated and how we can maintain that. So with that, I'm going to call up, first of all, Karen Marangel and Sabah Randhawa. Oh, yeah, and opening an informational meeting on university governance. Karen, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Dembrough. For the record, my name is Dr. Karen Marangel. I'm the Interim Vice Chancellor for Academic Strategies at the Oregon University System. I'm also a professor of mathematics and statistics at Portland State University.
Good morning, Chair Dembrough and members of the Council. I'm Sabah Randhawa. I'm Provost and Executive Vice President at Oregon State University.
Karen, you want to talk to us a little bit about how OUS coordinates programs right now?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Dembrough. So I am, as I said, I'm interim vice chancellor, so I'm rather new to the world of program coordination, though I have been with the system office for close to 2 years and have sat in on the provost council meetings, and so I'm familiar with the process, but still new to learning some of the details. So I hope some of that newness might prompt some questions for you, as it has for me. I'll give an overview of the process, and I know that Sabah will fill in some of the details, and especially from what this looks like from the campus level, and from the provost's level. Campuses decide to a program, or some faculty might decide that there's a need for a new program, an undergraduate degree, a graduate certificate, a graduate program. And there is fairly extensive channels that happen at the universities, so vetting of those ideas through Faculty Senate. So as you probably know, the universities highly value shared governance, and so Faculty Senates typically are responsible for moving programs, new program ideas, through the process and approving them. So that that process typically takes about 6 to 8 months of program vetting, getting partner disciplines to comment on the academic rigor of the program, the ideas, the need. There's typically a process of showing that there's some need for the graduates of the program, particularly in today's day and age, and with all of the focus on ensuring that our graduates get jobs when they graduate. There's usually some level of onus to show that there is an employment demand for a particular program, for instance. And then once the program has made its way through the campus channels, and honestly, a lot of programs don't make it through at that point, through that vetting process. Then the program goes to the Provost Council, and this is where the OUS office comes in. We help coordinate the provosts of the seven public institutions. And the provosts meet monthly, and part of the work of the provost council is to vet each other's programs. Now, prior to, typically in the way things work, though not part of the formal process, prior to a proposal coming to the provost council, if, say, Portland State was proposing to offer a new program in literature, they might vet that with other programs, well-known programs in literature in the state. So they might talk with the University of Oregon about how the program is complementary, not duplicative. And so there's a lot of, there's some behind-the-scenes work that goes on. Then the program formally comes to the Provost Council, where we vet that program as provost. So the provost, as the chief academic officers of the institution, have done their homework. They've brought the program back to their department faculty to raise questions and raise concerns, and we have a usually vigorous discussion about the program's strengths and merits and whether it's needed and necessary. And we take all of the documentation into consideration as we go through that review in the Provost Council. So that includes the need for the program, the proposed academic rigor of the program, any of the employment demand for such a program would all be taken into consideration. If the proposal then is given an upvote, so a vote to move forward, it then moves to the State Board of Higher Education's Academic Strategies Committee. And there, the Academic Strategies Committee members do yet another vetting of the proposal. And they also have a look, so they also have kind of a look from their different board member perspectives. So we have, you know, industry employers on that board, we have faculty members on the board, and so we get yet another level of somewhat different expertise. So they're not the academic officers, but it is a different set of eyes and expertise, and also people who understand what the statewide landscape looks like. I'll stress the importance of the going through those two processes. Bringing the provost together to look at those programs, we then have a kind of a complete snapshot of all of the programs in the state. So we're able to keep an eye out for duplication, where things are complementary, where we might have gaps. That's also the other thing that sometimes comes up is as a program is proposed, it might raise that, oh, we don't have, or we have a need in this other area. So it's critically important to the process that we have a statewide view of all of the programs, the whole portfolio or suite of programs as they move forward. The Academic Strategies Committee then gives the up or down vote on the program. And in either of these cases, at the Provost Council level or the Academic Strategies Committee level, there may be a vote to go back and do more work. So it's not a guarantee that the program will progress through. The proposal might need to go back to the campuses to have more work done on it, or there might be found that there's not a need for a program. So I'll stop there, and I'm happy to answer any questions. And
can I add a couple of things, Karen?
Please.
I've done a really good job of summarizing the overall process. A couple of things I want to add to what Karen said. One, just to stress again that the ultimate responsibility of approving or not approving a program rests with the State Board of Higher Education, looking at the overall picture in terms of both the institution as well as the system as a whole. The other thing that I wanted to point out was that one of the important functions, both in the OUS Provost Council as well as with the Academic Strategies Committee, is to see if the program also are aligned with the goals of the system. So, you know, at the institution level, we of course make sure that they're aligned with the strategic directions of, say, Oregon State University and just the portfolio of programs that we offer. But then getting to the system level, then, you know, how do they advance, for example, the access goal that the board has set collectively? How do they align with the quality and rigor goal that are set by the State Board of Higher Education? And in particular for graduate programs, there is an added step that in addition to all the internal validations, we also would like an external validation from, because a lot of the graduate programs, for example, produce graduates who ultimately, for example, go into teaching jobs or into research jobs. So we have an additional step where, in fact, we invite our peers from other institutions to come and assess the program before it goes even to the State Board of Higher Education. So there are some additional checks and balances to look at a broader picture as we move forward.
Great. Yes, Rep. Greenlick.
Why do we have a prohibition against duplication of programs? I mean, why not there be a program in Eastern Oregon and a program at OSU or something? I mean, what's all the... Who cares if they serve a function?
Do you want me to?
Sure.
Okay. Either way. Well, I mean, so there are certain programs where I think duplication is needed. So there are some core programs at each campus, for example, say in mathematics or in certain core areas, and there is local demand. Business is a good case in point, or education is a good case in point where there are significant local demands. But I think when we are looking at duplication, we are really looking at the more expensive programs for example, engineering is a good case in point, where in fact engineering programs, the infrastructure is very expensive, and so we don't want to have infrastructure at each and every university. Graduate programs is also a very good
we don't want to, but why don't we want to?
As I said, you know, part of it is the cost of the programs. Because, you know, with limited resources, I think the vision is that how do we provide key programs, how do we provide access to key programs without having them at each and every campus, because of the, you know, cost of programs in terms of infrastructure, in terms of faculty, that perhaps becomes quite prohibitive.
Chair Dembro, Representative Greenlick, this is a great question, and I think Sabah gave a great answer, and I'll underscore a couple of points. So, particularly with limited resources, we want to ensure that programs are going to serve the best amount of students, the most amount of students, and in the most effective ways. And it may be that that programs, particular programs, may be small at some places, and so we wouldn't want to duplicate a program at another place and put the cost and time and resources and also have to go through the vetting of the academic rigor of the program when at another, you know, there's a program already, say, in place at an institution. So it does hinge a lot on making sure that we're using our resources in the most effective ways possible across the suite of institutions. If there were need in a particular area, that's a different story, certainly. But for the duplicativeness question, we do have to take a look at where we're investing the dollars and making sure that we're making the wisest investments possible.
Sure, if I could just comment on that.
Okay, and then I have a comment. Go ahead.
I was involved in creating some of the helping to create the PhD programs at Portland State many years ago. And there were PhD programs at U of O and PhD programs at OSU, but there needed to be some PhD programs at Portland State. We needed to go through this exercise standing on our head, pretending that the PhD program at Portland State was different than the PhD program at U of O, even though it was needed in both places, because of this notion that there shouldn't be duplication. Well, it seems to me there shouldn't be useless duplication, but sometimes duplication is a useful thing to have.
Chair Dembro, Representative Greenlick, as a PSU faculty member in mathematics, and our PhD program in mathematics education was the first one outside of the system science program, so I understand the sensitivity around duplication. My view now, I think that it's less of an issue than it has been. So I absolutely understand, and I saw the hoops that we had to go through to get a PhD program in applied mathematics through even just a few years ago. I think that level of focus on duplication, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I think that has lessened a bit. So I think there's a better understanding of the needs to serve particular communities and market demand for certain programs. And that certainly has been a bigger part of the conversation than just not duplicating for not duplication's sake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, just following up on that, I think, I mean, one of the decisions that I think is still being made or is being worked on is the issue of School of Public Health, right? I mean, there's been an effort to develop it at Portland State and also at Oregon State, you know? And so there's, and to some extent, they've been in competition, but my understanding is that they're sort of different focuses for each one. I mean, that would be a good example of, you know, where these kinds of debates happen, right?
I've been very much involved in that one, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I think it's the same issue I was raising before. The program that's developing at OHSU and PSU as a joint program is developing at a similar time, and you have to pretend to be different. But in fact, PhD programs are always different based on the faculty and what they focus on. But it's this notion that somehow this is going to be different than that one. When neither of them have started, you don't know how either of them are going to merge. And there's room for both of them, apparently. I mean, that's where the oddness comes in. Where we're going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's the question. Is there a need for both of them? And how is that decision made? Sabah,
sure.
Could you?
Absolutely. Chair Dembro, in this particular case, you know, I really do believe there is a need for multiple programs, primarily because of the workforce needs in the area, and it really goes beyond PhD. It's certainly the doctorate, but it's also the professional masters that are part of public health suite of programs, and given the present need as well as the emerging need as healthcare workers retire over the next few decades, I think there is a significant need in the area. Now, the three institutions, Portland State, Oregon Health Sciences University, and OSU, have collaborated for a long time with the Oregon Master's Public, the OMPH program, Public Health program, for a long time. I think some of the complexities in this particular case are introduced really by the accreditation agency rather than by the institution. So that's the other factor that at times really comes into play. So really the first proposal, even in this case, was developing a joint program with the three institutions. But the complexities are around lead institutions and the commitments that each institution would have to make were more complicated than two programs in this particular case. So there's an additional factor that at times come into play, particularly in professional programs. But directly to your question, yes, in this particular case, there is a need. And I think in some ways the two programs can complement each other quite well.
Thank you. Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I need some clarification, and maybe I missed it in your setup for the panel and the discussion, but so that I'm not sitting here thinking, wondering, you know, what direction we're going to be heading. This is great information for what has been happening in the current process. Why are we listening to it? Is this process going to remain the same in the future? Or are we listening to this? Are we going to be involved in changing how this is done in the future under a new system? I just need some guidance so I know kind of what to listen to and what to anticipate.
Well, I'm glad you raised that question because that, yeah, actually all of this was to some extent set up for, you know, the further question of, you know, from your perspectives, do you see the status quo changing if we move to an environment in which universities have individual, you know, local governing boards? Can you imagine a situation in which we could have both local boards but still a coordinated system? And, you know, would it be your recommendation that that's the direction we move in? Or rather, you know, to have a situation in which there is essentially a kind of academic free-for-all. I think maybe I loaded that question a little too much. I'm sorry, but feel free to take it wherever you want.
Sure. Chair Dembrow, Vice Chair Hoffman, I think this is an important question as we think about the future of the system. Now, from a personal perspective, and I think to some degree also reflecting Oregon State University's viewpoint on this, you know, I think that we could still have this coordination even with independent boards, and actually there are a number of other cases, a number of really successful situations in other states where similar systems exist, where institutions have local boards, but at the state level there is still some coordination, particularly around academic programs. You know, to some degree, you know, as I said, the key focus really for the coordination is around collaboration and is around partnership and leveraging. And those values can still be attained with or without, you know, local board. So I think there still is a significant value in terms of that leveraging and partnership that comes. And it's you know, having local boards ain't going to change some of the dynamics overnight. So, for example, all of a sudden, it's not going to produce new resources. And any of our universities, you know, we can take any of the big universities or any of the smaller campuses by themselves don't have critical mass in key areas. And one of the ways we get to the critical mass of faculty and infrastructure is through collaboration across campuses. I can cite a number of programs from environmental sciences to nanoscience and technology to health, where in fact it's only through those collaborations that we have been able to compete successfully with other institutions. Just if you compare any of our institutions with major institutions, say in Texas, Ohio, Michigan, it's all three of the larger campuses taken together in any one of those, you know, Ohio State or Michigan State or A&M. So it's, those collaborations are really critical. And I think one of the things this type of conversation or process really helps is building those collaborations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So follow up, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
So I guess the work group didn't make the decision. It's not specifically spelled out in 270 or 2149. So are we going to be involved in deciding how it'll look, or do we punt that to heck? What are we looking at?
I believe that it is included in it's really included in the bill that we're going to be approving today. What is it? The 3120. You know, it's addressed in that. And 3120 is the bill that's looking at the larger governance issues. I believe that it is reflected in Senate Bill 270 as well. And it is in a framework manner reflected in 2149 as well. You know, that that there needs to be still coordination, but the assumption is that we'll be at the HEC level, that, you know, that the HEC will be doing program approvals.
Thank you.
Yeah. Rip
Corso. So it sounds like, I mean, that's a valuable piece that it sounds like is being addressed, so that's good. I do want to go back to what Rep. Greenlich was talking about in terms of multiple programs around the state. I think part of that, too, in terms of the difference, isn't even just different faculty, but wouldn't you agree that the mission of the college itself shapes differences in terms of a health program at Oregon State, for instance, which has a very different mission than, say, Portland State?
Mm-hmm. Chair Dembrow, Representative Gorsuch, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I didn't emphasize in my comments the importance of not only the system mission, but the individual institutional missions. And that absolutely will shape. And as part of the program approval process, institutions need to show that the new program is in line with the institution's mission. So that is a key part of that process.
Okay. Alex, I know a few of you have questions, but we have a president in the room. President Cullinan is here from Southern Oregon, and I think she would lend a useful additional voice to this conversation. So, Mary, do you mind coming up? Thanks.
Hello. Good morning, Chair Dembrough and members of the committee.
Could you introduce yourself?
I'm Mary Cullinan, for the record, president of Southern Oregon University.
Thank you. Welcome. Mary, do you want to just quickly react to what we're talking about right now, about, you know, this question about, you know, local autonomy versus system coordination?
Well, my first response is that I think we have a very good system that is fairly simple, where, as was described, a program goes through the university structures and then is looked at by the provosts and then taken forward to academic strategies and the board. There's a thoughtful process. It's discussed by the academics and by the board. And so that does, it does make sure that programs meet needs of students, that we're not creating programs that are really tiny and don't meet needs, that we're not stepping on each other's toes within the system, that the programs are not duplicative, where that would be an extraordinary expense. And the programs really are suited to the individual missions of the universities. In the case of the of Southern Oregon University, for instance, our master's programs are intended to be applied programs, not theoretical programs. They are meant to be particularly useful for the working professionals in Southern Oregon, such as the master's in teaching. And so those kinds of differences are looked at very carefully when you have a system that's able to review all the offerings. And so I would just hope that any changes that are made don't create more levels of complexity and also lead to a proliferation of programs that really has been kept in check through the system processes that we have now.
Thank you, Mary. So we had questions from Rep. Gallegos, Rep. Johnson, Rep. Wisnan, and now Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm following on Rep. Huffman's line of questioning, but with the changes of going to institutional boards, if in fact that occurs, that's also going to modify the role and purpose of the State Board of Higher Ed, because there will not, in all likelihood, be the need for that sort of governance in that board, because much of the governance will be happening at the local level and stuff. But a key part of your process here, Karen, is the ideas and so forth happen at the provost council level. Ideas are vetted by the academic folk, if you will. From there, that process then moves up to the state board, where you have a fresh set of eyes encompassing private sector people, different walks of life, that give a different look at it. But if that board, in fact, is not there in the capacity that they are there currently, it seems to me we've got a problem with the process, which doesn't mean it can't be fixed, but I'm not aware of anywhere in any other proposal that specifically address that situation yet. So I think that's something that we have to focus on. And I'm confused. And I think a lot of other people probably are too, about how that process will continue in a way that ensures that that system-wide vetting continues in a way that still is good for the system, and who in fact does that and makes those evaluations and so forth in a more, let's just say, dispersed governance world. It's not clear to me where that, maybe you have ideas. Karen, I don't know if you guys kick around those thoughts around the water cooler or how that works.
Chair Dembrough, Representative Johnson, thank you for the very good question. We do kick around these questions at the water cooler from time to
time. And other places too, other watering holes, I'm sure.
I think your point about the importance, and I also obviously value the importance of having the perspectives of folks from outside academics, but who are familiar with the academic process, so industry folks and other community members, having an eye and vetting the proposals is very important. And so whether that resides with the State Board of Higher Education or the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, I think that part of it, that structure stuff, you know, you have ideas about that. But we would like to preserve that part of our process. And I think as President Cullinan described the simplicity of the process, we'd want to keep it, you know, much like it is now. I don't think it matters whether it's with the State Board of Higher Education or with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. That there is one body that will do that is the important part, and that we also preserve the provost, that the academic officers at the institutions also have a chance to talk together. That two-step process, in its simplicity, works as a checks and balances process right now. And I would highlight the comments, the earlier comments about collaboration. It's been a delight as a faculty member to come and watch provosts work together and collaborate. And this has been a process that's built up over many, many, many years. It is not going to go away overnight. And that if institutional boards are there, I still think that the members of the Provost Council value the work that they do together and would not want to see that go away. I've come to understand the great power in terms of collaboration of convening and bringing people together. And as long as there is a you know, someone there to help shepherd that process along, where it sits doesn't matter.
And let me just quickly say, you know, in the model that is envisioned in House Bill 3120, that work would reside now in the new Office of Post-Secondary Education, in the university side of that shop, essentially. I believe, I don't know that we need to call it out in statute, you know, call out the Council of Provosts, the Provost Council, but the assumption is that's where that work would continue to happen.
Thank you. So,
Just
to follow up, I guess, I think there's a difference between having that function occur via staff or a volunteer appointed board, a lay board, if you will. You know, those are two different types of criteria, I think, or two different types of eyes. Mm-hmm. And I do think it would be helpful to make that function specific somehow, to where we can know rather than just simply say it'll be to be determined.
No, I think if I could respond, I think, you know, the thinking is that just as today, you know, what we think of as OUS or the Chancellor's Office sort of houses that activity, and getting it ready for approval by the State Board of Higher Education. I think the assumption is that that's what the Office of Post-Secondary Education would do, working out the details that would be finally approved by the HEC. So that it would essentially be replicating what we currently have. But the other thing is that the post-secondary office would also be dealing with community college issues. And that's something we haven't actually talked about. But, at some point I'd like you to address the extent to which program approvals include the community colleges currently.
So, Chair Dembrough, if I may, we have started having conversations about this, and in fact, the provost recently met with the instructional administrators from the community colleges. Every year, we have a joint meeting together. In preparation for that meeting, we did start to take a look at the processes, and they're quite different because the Council of Instructional Administrators don't meet, A, as frequently as the provosts do, and B, the substance of their meetings is not to approve programs. So from my understanding, aside from career technical education, and I apologize if I'm misrepresenting any of this, but the career technical education programs do go through a sort of program approval, but new programs, say in mathematics or in history, as part of the associate's degree, do not. And so we have identified a bit of a disjuncture just in the way that the program approval processes happen with the community colleges and the provosts. That we need to spend some time giving that some thought about how that might play out, how that would look different, how it would meet the needs, and if there's reason to bring the two together. And I'm not sure. I don't know. We haven't really gone down that line of thinking yet.
Thank you.
Chair Dembrough, if I can just If I may just add, I think with the community colleges, perhaps the bigger issue is to ensure that the pathways exist between, since community colleges typically are not offering degree programs. So I think there the issue is more to ensure that there are appropriate pathways between community colleges and four-year universities or the degree programs that are offered at the four-year universities. But as Karen said, you know, we have started those type of conversations with our counterparts at the community colleges to ensure that how do we ensure that the time to graduation for students who start in the community colleges and ultimately ends up at one of our institution can be minimized in this particular process.
Right. Yes.
And Chair Dambrell, I would just like to add to that all of the institutions have multiple agreements with our community colleges. And so, for instance, we share a building in Medford with Rogue Community College, and we work on all the programs to make sure that pathway is as efficient as possible. And so we're working on general education, we're working on, you know, criminal justice, on all the pieces. So there's already hundreds of those agreements in place. Certainly we could tighten up and streamline, but I think there's been decades of really good work.
Right. Yes. And I think one of the impulses behind the new post-secondary office is to, you know, ramp that up, to streamline, to coordinate all of that much more vigorously. Rep. Gallegos.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And thank you for the presentation. I find the presentation very helpful. It reminds me of the process that we have to go through to create programs. And as someone who, as a professor who's developed a number of curriculum programs and taken them from conception through accreditation, I wouldn't say it's a simple process at all, but I can appreciate really the complexity of the process, and I think, like I said, that's helpful. My question really has to do with something different. It has to do with timing and the rapidity to which our institutions are able to respond to the needs out there. In other words, so if we compare this process to the process that, say, a for-profit institution might need to go through, are we disadvantaged because of the process? And I guess really the underlying my question is, would institutional local boards help that process be any more quick to respond, I guess?
Chair Dunn, Representative Gallegos, a very good question. The process from the time that the proposals get to the Provost Council and then go to the Academic Strategies Committee for undergraduate programs is fairly short. That can happen in a fairly short amount of time. With the graduate programs, there is the extra step of external review. The campuses, that timeline on the campuses, that's where a lot of the adjustment can happen. And I know that at Portland State, with some of the new Rethink PSU initiatives, they're looking to try to shorten that on the campuses. Institutional boards might have a say or might take up shortening that time, or they might not, or the campus faculty, ultimately that will rest with the campus faculty senate to decide on those processes. And so I'll leave it to my colleagues to comment more, but that campus... the campus level vetting is the one that I think, in my perspective, takes the longest amount of time. So I absolutely agree. That is a bit of a hindrance to getting us to respond to needs. But we want to do it in a thoughtful way, and in a way that we're going to ensure that our graduates are actually then ready to step into those jobs and be work ready.
Yeah. Rep. Wisman, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really have this was informative for me, not working in the academic profession. President, good to see you again.
Nice to see you.
And I can either ask the questions offline or whatever, but we mentioned using external evaluations. I'd like to know how frequent and how expensive that is, and also know if this group goes back and looks at existing programs to see if we can reduce some of the core requirements to expedite graduation and to put these people in the employment workplace.
Sure. Chair Denbrough, Representative Visnin, there is some added cost for external review, but I think part of it is sort of a voluntary system. We do it for other institutions; they do it for us, and so there is without a doubt some operational costs that are involved in terms of producing documents, in terms of faculty administrative time that is involved. But most of it is really at a voluntary level in terms of inviting people to be part of this particular process. And as I said, it's a two-way street, and we do, you know, the same thing for other institutions. With regard to your second question, each of our institutions have in place processes for periodically reviewing academic programs. Some of them are necessitated by accreditation requirements. So, for example, engineering programs are accredited every 6 years or earlier, depending if there are any issues. So all the professional programs, business, education, engineering, pharmacy, et cetera. So there is a requirement from accreditation agencies to revisit those programs. But even for other programs, particularly in the arts and sciences, where there aren't any external accreditation agencies, each of the institutions have policies in place to review programs at least on a 5 to 7 year cycle. So at OSU, we review programs every 7 years in terms of 5 to 7 years if they're not being accredited, to make sure that they are meeting the intended needs. Students are being gainfully employed after they graduate. That there are core faculty who are qualified to deliver the programs, and it's adaptive as times change over, you know, in terms of the programs itself.
Thank you. Just the comment is, I've been to a couple of conferences where there is a movement to try to go back and look at the core requirements to see if they to expedite again, because they're not always available, so we can expedite the four-year graduation to achieve our 40-40-20. So I hope this process or whatever we come up with will continue to do that. Thank you.
Of course.
I wanted to go back to the connection between community college and higher ed. I think there's one other area I think you might have referred to articulation agreements, and we certainly have many of those between community colleges and not just public universities but also private. The other piece, though, that always links us is that if we want to offer a new class, we have to send out letters of transferability to the universities. And if the universities don't think that's a viable class, a worthwhile class, or whatever, then they'll kill that process. So there is some checking back with the university system so that we're not offering classes that, and like you were saying, Rep. Wisnett, we're not offering classes that basically cost kids more money, students more money, and go nowhere. So I think that's and it's a very valuable connection so that we're not creating things that don't connect up with higher ed. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Rep. Greenlee?
It's my impression that the provost at OHSU has continued to serve on that provost council, and that OHSU's education programs or new programs have also been coordinated in that same way. Is that right? So even though they're outside of the OUS.
Yes, Chair Denbrough, Representative Greenlee, yes, that is the case, that OHSU still participates in the provost council.
And that's sort of a model. I was wondering what keeps that happening and how can that be guidance on this whole.
Good point.
Yes. Well, I think that is what we're looking at. Even though they have a board, they still are part of a system. And so that is the issue of how can we maintain the system even while we have local boards.
Right.
And you know, that is, again, you know, the sweet spot that, you know, I feel that we have to hit. Okay, thank you all. Sama, I would ask you to remain up here, though, because I want to shift the conversation briefly to statewide programs, and I know Oregon State has so many of them.
Sure.
Thank you very much, Mary
thank
Karen.
You.
And I'll call up Bob Bussell from Labor Education Research Center, which is one of those programs that's Theirs is housed on a campus but has a statewide reach. So, Bob, you want to talk to us about your situation and how you see perhaps Lurk living in a world in which the University of Oregon might have a board?
Yes, thank you, Chair Denbrough, Vice Chairs Parker and Huffman, and members of the committee. My name is Bob Bussell. I'm an associate professor of history, and I'm the director of the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. I've held this post since 2002. I very much appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today and talk about LIRC. Our activity consists of teaching, research, and public service related to issues of work, employment, and labor relations. So first, I'd like just to provide you with a brief overview of our activities in each of these important areas. So LIRC is a campus-based public service program. We were established by an act of the Oregon Legislature in 1977, and I think the best way perhaps to understand us is as an extension program. So much as there are extension programs that assist agriculture, forestry, and business, LIRC extends the resources of the university to labor organizations and other constituencies involved in the areas of work and employment. And there are about 30 of these programs similar to ours, mostly at public universities across the country. And although we are based at the U of O, we provide our services on a statewide basis, and we see our work as an integral part of the university's obligation to improve the quality of life for all the citizens of Oregon. So let me just talk briefly about each of these areas, teaching, research, and service. One of our core commitments is to provide affordable, accessible instructional service, and this is primarily on a non-credit basis to adult learners. So just to give you a sense of numbers, in the past 2 years, our six-person faculty has conducted 105 educational programs that were attended by over 4,000 persons. So these include subjects such as grievance handling, collective bargaining, and labor law that help workers have an effective voice on the job. More recently, we've addressed concerns such as bullying in the workplace, workplace violence, and generational conflict. We've also conducted numerous trainings around joint labor management efforts and cooperative efforts. Those have included efforts at a hospital in Coos Bay, at Kaiser Permanente, and with the city of Portland. And we're especially proud of having helped educate several generations of labor leaders in Oregon in the practice of positive labor relations. Many of our students have gone on to top leadership positions, not only in their unions, but in their communities, testifying to the effectiveness of our efforts. The second leg of what we do at LIRC, in addition to teaching, is research. And this is applied research that is of immediate and direct use to our various constituencies. So, for example, we just completed our third study titled All Costs Considered 3 that reviewed the contracting of school support services in Oregon. And already the findings of this report are being used by school districts and school boards in helping evaluate the relative merits of contracting out. A 2008 report of ours, The Immigrant Experience in Oregon, brought together scholars from across the university, and we examined changing demographics in Oregon, and particularly in Oregon's workplaces. And as part of the type of public work we do, we not only did the research, we went out and made numerous public presentations to audiences across the state, acquainting people with the implications of this work as far as our changing demographics. We've also conducted research on the effectiveness of apprenticeship programs in the construction trades, and we recently developed a curriculum to help unions in the construction trade retain and attract members of underrepresented groups to these important and long-lasting occupations. And we finally have a long history of research in the arena of occupational safety and health. Most recently there, we've been involved in a program that is trying to reduce violence directed against people who provide home health care services, in people's homes. And this is research, again, is applied. It's also going to be used to design interventions that help to protect those workers from violence that, unfortunately, they all too frequently experience. And finally, in addition to teaching and research, the third leg or pillar of what we do is our rich tradition of community and public service. So let me just give you a few examples of that. And this assumes multiple forms. Barbara Bird, who is a longtime faculty member at LIRC, shares her experience on green jobs and workforce development as a member of the Governor's Green Jobs Council. And Barbara also serves on the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. Helen Moss has played an integral role in the Oregon Young Employee Safety Program. This is a consortium of private employers, public agencies, unions, and nonprofits that's devoted to preventing injuries and accidents that, again, occur all too frequently with young workers. So Helen has coordinated the dissemination of a curriculum called Talking Safety that's aimed specifically at helping young workers be safe on the job. And affirming the effectiveness of this curriculum, the Oregon Youth Authority now requires young offenders who are entering work assignments to actually go through this curriculum before they actually go on the job. So again, I think you see the various connections between our work, the research, and the public service elements, as well as our teaching. And also, I've been involved with the Immigration Task Force of the Eugene Human Rights Commission, and have convened a group in Eugene and Springfield that is aiming to enhance the integration of immigrants into our communities down there. And just the last thing, I know there are just many of these, glad to talk about other things we do. We host a biennial public employee relations conference, and this is a much anticipated event, occurs biennially. There are 300,000 labor and management practitioners in the public sector that come together to talk about positive public employee relations. And I think rare among my experience in this field, members of the Employee Relations Board come down and actually talk about their decisions. So there's a kind of Oregon way, I think, in terms of work and employment relations that LURC, I think, very much fits into.
300,000?
300, excuse me. Oh. Yeah, just 300, not 300,000. Yeah, we don't even have...
wow.
Yeah.
Trying to picture the room.
Yeah, sorry about that. I haven't exaggerated anything else. But 300 is about what we get for that conference. So let me just, by way of summary, say this, that at our event a few years ago celebrating LURC's 30th anniversary, UO President Emeritus Dave Frohnmayer, I think, very well summarized the significance of our work. Quote, LURC embodies the public service commitment of the University of Oregon. It is one of the U of O's most successful units in integrating the three essential functions of the university, teaching, research, and service. I should add that we do this work on an annual budget of under $1 million that has been essentially flat for the last decade. LURC wants to keep on being what I like to call the little program that could. However, as a statewide public service program, we need continued university and legislative support to maintain the level of service that our constituents have come to expect and that we are proud to provide. And we hope that this service will be sustained under, support will be sustained under whatever arrangements may emerge during the restructuring of higher education in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. So, Bob, could you talk to us a little bit about some of the statewide that Oregon State does? Thank you.
Sure. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity and invitation to share a little bit about the statewide public service programs. So Oregon State's statewide public service program, first of all, are part of OSU's land-grant mission. They have been mandated by separate, long-standing federal legislation, some over 100 years old. The statewide programs actually consist of three separate programs. Consist of an agriculture experiment station, forest research lab, and the Oregon Extension Service. They are common in many respects, and there are some differences between the three programs, particularly between Ag Experiment Station and Forest Research Lab and the Extension Service. So all three programs really focus on addressing key issues, emerging issues that are important to Oregon industry, to Oregon communities, and to Oregon businesses. And they all, in different ways, significantly leverage state investment. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. The Ag Experiment Station and the Forest Research Lab are more the research entities, if you would, the research arms. As far as Experiment Station is concerned, it's a sort of the principal research engine, if you would, related to food, agriculture, and natural processes. And similarly, the Forest Research Lab really focuses on the science and management of forests in Oregon. And if you were to consider that almost 22% of Oregon's economy flow from agriculture and forest sector, about 50% of Oregon's land is covered with forest, and perhaps another 25% is focused on ag production. That's a significant component of Oregon. The type of issues, the type of activities that the experiment station and the research lab engage in, just to give you a few sort of broad examples, vary from food processing and packaging technology to production and use of forest products from ocean and estuaries, to rangeland ecology and livestock management in the eastern part of the state, to viticulture and ecology in the valley, to new crop varieties, to bio-based energy systems. With the forestry, we particularly focused on silvicultural methods to improve resilience to pest, fires, and other issues, to management practices that provide sustainability of forest and the balance between management and long-term health of the forest, and also to production of new materials for wood composites, for plywoods, for minimizing waste and use of technology in secondary wood products manufacturing. The Extension Service is a slightly different beast, different animal here. And what it does, it really connects, it takes the research and really connects it to actual practices in Oregon communities. And some of it has to do with agriculture and forestry, but some of it also has to do in other areas. And so, for example, in health and nutrition, in pre-K, K-12 education to students and preparing them to move on to post-secondary education, it plays a pretty critical role. Collectively, the three entities leverage about $45-46 million in research in state funding, with almost about $100 million in external grants and contracts in competitive funding. The Forest Research Lab, all in addition, has a one-to-one match through timber harvesting tax that the industry provides to match state funding. With the Extension Service, 21 counties now have passed local service districts where they provide money. It's a partnership between state, federal, and counties. So 21 counties have local service districts, and the others provide appropriation for general funds. And with the Extension Service also, there's a workforce, in addition to about 170 faculty, of almost 15,000 trained volunteers. That's almost equivalent to about 800 full-time employees that provide a lot of leveraging to the type of services that is provided. The faculty in the three programs are fully integrated in academic colleges. So many of the faculty teach. They provide mentorship to students, both at the undergraduate and graduate level. They provide sort of a laboratory, if you would, for pre-K-12 for students, particularly in rural areas where it's difficult to come to Corvallis or Portland or Eugene. So there's a significant amount of activity that goes on from that particular level too. So really one of the complexities is that it's truly integrated into the teaching, research, and outreach mission of the university. In terms of going forward, in terms of local boards or the current system, the statewide public service programs are really key to the mission of the university, and so I do not see them changing, whether there's a local board or there's a coordinating board as we have at the moment or any other system, because that's really the core of the institution that we are talking about.
Mm-hmm. I guess the question is, I'm wondering if that's something that we need to really spell out in statute. And I say that because, what if, for example, the OSU board decided, it wanted to use its resources differently,
sure.
And that could potentially compromise these statewide programs. And the same thing, at U of O, if the university decided it wanted to change things, and then we would lose that statewide entity. And so I'm wondering how we can prevent that from happening.
Chair Dembro, an excellent question. And, the case that we have made, even in the current scenario, the current situation, is that even though there are separate line item funding for statewides versus the education and general fund, to treat them the same, because the faculty really are integrated with the rest of the institution. And I think, I think from my perspective, you make an excellent point that how do we ensure that that core mission of the institution ain't diluted as the functional or the organizational structure changes, that the mission is not impacted in terms of ensuring that going forward. I think it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, sometimes that, happens right now. I created the Oregon Health Policy Institute at three universities and had it approved through the system, and I was intended to serve this kind of function. But I never could get sufficient. As long as I was a department chair and had my own money, I could keep it going. But when I left the chair and needed to get some university
buy-in,
some modest university buy-in, I was talking about, say, $50,000 a year for three universities, I wasn't able to get it. And I think it's still sleeping somewhere, but it's never had a function. So, I think your point is the university commitments to these statewide things is very significant. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Rep. Johnson?
Well, you raise a very good point, Mr. Chair. And as we've heard today, and I can tell you from firsthand experience in my district, the presence of the OSU Extension offices are vital to our agricultural industry in my area. And I know we're just one part of the state, but I know that our state economy, the success of our state economy to a large extent depends upon their ability to be there and to be innovative and to stay one step ahead of what really is happening out there in the agricultural and forest practice and so forth. And right now they fit perfectly within the mission of the university. I think everybody understands that and can't foresee that relationship changing, but our state depends upon those extension offices being there and being operated and maintained and so forth. So whatever we could do to spell that out to ensure that we envision that those them continuing to some degree going forward, I think would be beneficial.
Okay. Chair Dembro, Representative Johnson, I couldn't agree with you less. Absolutely. And so as I said, particularly with over time with state cuts, we have tried to look at alternatives, for example, competitive funding or other sources. But typically it comes with trade-offs. So, you can go to competitive funding, but that may not totally align with the needs of local communities, and so it's really important that that support is sustained.
Thank you. Well, thank you both very much. And let me say before we leave, Bob, I'm very familiar with the work of LURC, and I've been to those conferences which bring together professionals, advocates for workers and management. No, there haven't been 300,000, but the day always feels as if it lasts 300,000 hours. But no, it's actually a very interesting and useful and as you say, unique opportunity for people on all sides of issues to come together and interact with the Employment Relations Board. It's really very productive.
Yeah.
So, thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Colleagues, with that, I'm going to close this informational hearing on university governance. Okay, so I just don't open it. Okay. All right, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2149. No one has signed up to speak to this. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to speak to House Bill 2149? Okay, seeing no one, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2149. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3120.
Mr. Chair, we have some -2 amendments, and I would move that we adopt the -2 amendments dated March 21st, 2013.
Okay, Representative Harker moves to adopt the -2 amendments dated March 21st, 2013. Okay, colleagues, you have at your seats a copy of a summary that our good administrator has, with her usual skill, put together for us of the elements of House Bill 3120-2. And again, just to remind you, these dash two amendments are the bill. And I thought what we would do is just very quickly walk through these, just to let you know what is in this bill. I want to remind you that we you know, concurrently with our conversations, we have a work group that has been established of a variety of representatives of the entities that will be affected by this bill. Rep. Johnson and I are your representatives on that work group. And we are hoping in the next few weeks to get this into shape where we can actually ask you to vote on it. So, if we just go through this very quickly, and you'll see this is a very long bill, but as usual with this kind of thing, most of it is just conforming amendments. And I would encourage you to use your valuable time to read through all those conforming amendments. Because
Emperor typos.
Yeah, right.
No, I'm being semi-facetious. But actually, for me, in reading them over, it kind of reminded me of just all these programs that are out there. And it is kind of interesting. Programs that either the OSAC or CCWD or the university system are involved in. But okay, so if we just quickly go through this.
The basic question?
Yes, please.
Why do we include workforce development in the name? And I'm seriously raising that issue. It seems to me there are several functions of post-secondary education, so it doesn't say post-secondary education and intergenerational mobility or other things. Why focusing on the workforce development as a piece of post-secondary education, highlighting it at such a high level?
Yeah, well, you know, what this bill does is, basically creates the new Office of Post-Secondary Education Workforce Development, and it's taking three agencies and bringing them together. Okay, it's taking the Oregon Student Access Commission, the Oregon University System, and the Community Colleges and Workforce Development Department. And that workforce development part, element is a very important component of CCWD. Yes, but not in the same way. The CCWD includes a number of different, dedicated programs, many of them using federal money, that are doing workforce development in this state.
Well, I don't have an issue with the importance of workforce development. I just believe a university system, and this is the office that's going to manage basically.
Among other things, it will include the university system, it will include the community colleges, and it will include workforce development for the state.
Well, then why isn't it called higher post-secondary education and community colleges?
Post-secondary includes community colleges.
Just leave it at post-secondary.
That's what I think it should be. I'm not sure what should be, but I'm going to raise this issue as an important issue. Okay. I think we're moving towards our view of university education as being about job creation, which it is, but it's also about lots of other important functions.
It's about education.
It's about education.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think all of that is included in the term education, but we can talk more about this.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. The first section establishes this new office whose job is to be, as it were, the operational arm of the HEC, the operational support for the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, but also providing direct services to the community colleges to the universities and to OSAC. To make that happen, Section 2 transfers to this new office the current functions and powers of OSAC, CCWD, and ODA, the Office of Degree Authorization, which oversees the career schools. It moves oversight of the community colleges from the State Board of Education to the HEC. That's basically what that section does.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Please.
About that, Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Down in Section 10 and 11 again, talks about transferring everything out of OSAC, but mm-hmm. Section 10 talks about OSAC as being advised to advise. I'm not sure what advise means, particularly when it doesn't have any functions left, since all the functions have been.
So the plan is, so currently we have an OSAC board, right, which is an independent board in the same way that we have, you know, State Board of Ed, OUS board. There's an OSAC board, and it will under this scenario no longer be a governing board. The HEC will be the oversight board for OSAC, but there is still a need for the for there to be an advisory committee, and so that's essentially what the OSAC, you know, current commission will become, relying on the expertise of the, you know, the people, the kind of people who currently serve on the OSAC board. They will be advisory to the HEC on issues related to student financial aid and that whole endeavor.
I thought the language said, as I read the language in 10, it talks about OSAC, not the OSAC board being advisory.
OSAC is the commission.
Yeah. Right.
Or
OSAC
the is the board is the commission.
Right. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, I read it this morning.
Yeah.
That's what I didn't know what that meant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's the intent. If the language is confusing, we can try to get it clarified. Section 3, the HEC will have a director. I mean, we're using the term director now. Currently CCWD has a commissioner. OUS has a chancellor. OSAC has a director. For now, we're using the term director for this role. That perhaps could change. But this is the person who will oversee the new Office of Postsecondary Education. And this person will report to the HEC. The HEC currently has, on paper, an executive director position. That position has never been filled. And, you know, essentially that's what this person will become. So that person will be hired and will report to, hired by and will report to the HEC. Section 4, this has to do with rules, rulemaking. Section 5. Legal issues, Section 6, take oaths and issue subpoenas, Section 7, there will be a fund in the state treasury to support these activities, Section 8 allows the director to be appointed during the transition period in which this is all coming together, and colleagues, the thinking here is that if we do pass this legislation this session, there will be a year's transitional period. The new office will come into being July 1st of 2014.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could I go back to section three?
Yes.
I'm actually looking at the language in the amendments, but it calls for the HEC appointing the director of the Office of Post-Secondary and so forth. Did that spell any sort of a process in place for that? I know there are other issues. I mean, we talked about appointment process and so forth, that those are more clearly spelled out, who then serves at the pleasure of the commission. Beyond that, then, the director then, once the director's in place, the director then has the ability to appoint any deputy directors as found to be necessary and appropriate and so forth. And I guess what I'm having a hard time visualizing is, yes, maybe we are consolidating some of the top management, i.e. maybe we don't have a chancellor, maybe we eliminate some of those positions, but it still seems like it's hard for me to see how we are a leaner organization at the end of the day, since we are still appointing the same sort of people to take on the duties that are currently need to be carried out, and I'm just having a hard time wrapping my mind around, at the end of the day, is this really a leaner, more efficient process, or have we just simply reconstituted something else? And
I think that's a fair question.
It would be helpful if the members could actually look through, you know, because there's a lot more detail in here, obviously, than in the summary. You know, Victoria's done a great job, but it just helps me to actually go through and try to visualize how this process plays out step by step by step.
Right.
And that would happen over the course of the next year, then, upon passage. You'd have a year to try to get this in place, but I'm just trying to see how that could be a seamless and as unsettling process as possible, because that's a difficult environment to play in for people that are currently serving, obviously, and then who ultimately will be fulfilling those roles or taking those places. So.
And, you know, let me say that, you know, the purpose of today's introduction is for you to articulate any immediate questions that you have or concerns, and then, you know, as the weeks go on, you know, we'll refine those more and more. I think, you know, just the long-term vision is that, you know, by bringing the, you know, the three agencies together into one, over time, there will be efficiencies that will come about as a result of that. You know, if, you know, I don't know that we want to spell those out at this point, but that is, you know, something for us to consider. That is one of the goals of this, to come up with a more efficient delivery system and more efficient support system for the HEC, but at the same time, not just more efficient, but more effective in guaranteeing better, you know, more collaborations and you know, closer articulation among those three sectors. So, the one other thing I should mention is with respect to the reporting relationship. What we're doing here is essentially just replicating the current system for the commissioner of community colleges and the director and the chancellor. They all report to their respective boards. There was, in its initial conception, the draft had the director reporting to the governor and, you know, via the chief education officer. But, you know, based on some advice that I received and some others have received, it's really better to have them reporting to the board as opposed to the governor. The board will be appointed by the governor, you know, and so, you know, the governor has a role to play. But as a way of, you know, separating that position from, you know, the direct line of authority of the governor is deemed to be more stabilizing.
Why? You explain some of the advice you
received. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, and this was advice that we received from Dennis Jones from NCHEMS, the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, that, you know, looking around the country, when you have people in that position, you know, a chancellor or, you know, someone in a comparable position who reports directly to the governor, those chancellors tend to be changed very often. you know, often, you know, with the governor. The governor will change the chancellor. And based on the experience that he observed, that can be very destabilizing for a system.
And our chief education officer will still have functions without having the people reporting to him who do what he's supposed to be directing.
Yes, and the chief education officer currently does oversee the chancellor and the commissioner in some respects in terms of, working on the overall articulation of the pre-K-20, continuum. But he doesn't have hiring and firing authority over them.
I know, which means he's not convinced he has any function, but the issues are going to be, will there still be a chief education officer with relation to higher ed?
That, yes. Yes, although I'm not sure that we have, how exactly we've articulated that. But that is a good question, and we do need to, we do need to look at that carefully. I will say that some of the language, you'll notice that some of the language in the bill is somewhat duplicative, and that's because the references to the OEIB have to envision the possibility that we don't have an OEIB, because the OEIB sunsets in, I think it's 2016. The language is written, one scenario in which we have an OEIB and another in which we don't. We had to do that actually with Senate Bill 242, I think, where the HEC has a relationship with the OEIB, but if we don't have an OEIB, then the HEC takes over those responsibilities that the OEIB has for higher ed. Yeah. Okay. So, moving on. The next section deals specifically with OSAC, and then the following section, almost parallel language, with respect to the transfer of CCWD. And then the next section eliminates that position that is in place but unfilled of the executive director of the HEC. And then the next section, with respect to the Office of Degree Authorization, which currently, in a kind of strange way, the ODA reports directly to the HEC. The HEC is basically currently a coordinating body, but it does have direct governance over the Office of Degree Authorization. And we did that because I think there was no other place to put ODA, and so that's where they are currently. ODA used to report to OSAC for no reason other than there was no other place to put it. It's been this kind of wandering tribe. But really, I think it really does belong. I do believe that in this new Office of Post-Secondary Education, it will have found its logical home.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I hate to keep going backwards.
No,
I've got a question back at the end of Section 3.
Yeah.
Subject to any applicable provisions of ORS Chapter 240, the director may appoint, prescribe the duties for, fix the compensation of any other officers, employees whom the director considers necessary to carry out the duties, function, powers of the office. Mm-hmm. Whose budget is this director going to be having access to? Are we melding all of CCWD's resources, OUS, all of the above?
Yes.
That will be the budget that will provide for the staffing and the expenses necessary to carry out the functions. Is that what's in view here?
That's correct.
Okay.
And it, you know, I think the assumption is that it will maintain the current appointment process, not only for the director, but, you know, for the subsidiary positions as well. So just as, you know, the chancellor has appointing authority with board approval for, you know, the vice chancellors, so that would be similar under this new scenario.
This would appear to give the director the authority to do whatever without another check in there, as I read this.
And I'm not sure if maybe the statutory references deal with that. But
I'm not sure what 240 references,
yeah.
Or F-240. Just a thought.
No, that's an important point. I think, you know, the thinking is that it will just continue the current practice. So whatever, and I don't know if, you know, the commissioner in appointing Elizabeth, for example, who's in the room, did she need to get board approval for that? Or the chancellor, when he appoints a vice chancellor, does he need board? No. But how about creating a new position? Presumably, though, it has to fit within the OUS budget, which is approved by the State Board of Higher Ed. And presumably, it would be something similar under this new scenario.
Can you articulate the answers you're getting?
Oh. Testifying? Yes. Yeah, I'm getting head nods from experts in the audience.
Occasional shaking of heads also.
Okay. Okay, moving along. Bonding provisions. Again, I think this just maintains current practice as far as bonding goes, but we'll obviously have to look into that. Then sections 41 through 298 are the conforming amendments. See, efficiencies can be found, right? And then the HEC. So here it does a few things. First of all, one of the provisions that was put into the current HEC statute, and I'm not quite sure why exactly that this was put in there, even though I was part of it, and so were you, Rep. Johnson, but there was a provision that the HEC could not include current members of the State Board of Higher Ed or the State Board of Ed, I think, or something like that. I think it cut us off from some good talent that we could have had. And so I asked the drafter to remove that section because it really didn't seem to have a purpose. The statute that created the HEC had two students on it, but no faculty members, although faculty members, I believe, are serving on the HEC. But this just calls it out and clarifies that one faculty member should be from a university and one from a community college, just to make sure that both sides of the shop are represented. And Section 302 is a new one, directs the HEC to form a subcommittee to determine how to fund quality post-secondary education and submit recommendations to the governor. That is, it clarifies that that's one of the purposes of the HEC, is to do that strategic planning.
Finally, enough money.
Yes, and we know that their recommendations will be followed by the governor and by this body, right? If we approve this bill. Section 303 that just sunsets this this subcommittee. It should actually be 2017.
Oops, sorry about that.
I think 2017 is
better. Okay. Questions? Yes, Rep. Greenlee.
What happens if we don't pass this? I mean, what's the state of the situation? Are there some things we have to pass for some reason, or we leave a, what happens if we leave the situation as it is? What is the situation as it is?
Well, a lot depends on what happens with the university board bill, right? If we pass the university board bill and we don't pass this one, then I fear that we're going to be left with a broken up system, really, because you know the university board bill assumes that the individual universities will go to the HEC for their funding requests, right? The HEC will be doing the ask of the governor for their funding, as well as the coordination of the academic programs. Currently, the HEC is a great group, ably led by Betty Duvall, who's in the audience, but it is it doesn't have the kind of support that it needs to really do that kind of oversight.
You mean the kind of official support, legislative support, statutory support?
Yeah. Financial and operational.
Right.
The only staff support that it gets for its work comes through voluntary donations from OUS and from CCWD. What this will do in creating the new office, it will give it the ability to, you know, do the kind of research that's needed, you know, in for program approvals and all of those other things that will have to happen.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, this is a rather massive thing.
Yes.
And the question is,
we agree.
What problems are we trying to solve with this? And as we then assess this, to what extent will this solve the problems? And to what extent are there other less massive alternatives that might deal with the same problems we have? I'm just trying to find out where we're going, or even more importantly, I'm trying to find out why we're going in the direction this is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we can find out whether we got there when we get the first final look at this.
Right. Yeah, so part, you know, I think the key problem that we face in the state, you know, right now with respect to coordination is we really have a fragmented oversight system in the state for the different sectors of post-secondary, right? We have one, the community colleges, which are overseen, they're governed to the extent that they're governed by the State Board of Education, which is primarily focused on K-12. We have the universities that have their board, State Board of Higher Education. We have the scholarship entity, you know, the need-based scholarship entity, OSAC, which is governed by its board. These three entities are making decisions that are very, you know, very closely aligned to one another. They overlap to a great extent, but they're being done by three different boards. And then there's also a coordinating board, the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, that then, you know, adds a further level of coordination.
Well, we passed in the last session, or whenever the hell we did, a reorganization model. So we created OEIB, and we created the HEC, and we created the Chief Academic Officer.
Right.
Or whatever, Chief Education Officer. And how are they doing? I mean, that was, what, 2 years ago or something?
Mm-hmm.
So are we
somehow abandoning that and starting over, or?
No, I mean, one of the things that was mentioned at the time and that was called out specifically last session in House Bill 4061 was a desire to consolidate some of these boards. And so that's what we're trying to do here.
Right. When we created the HEC, we did not want to be creating an additional layer. We were doing that to achieve some efficiencies, and here we're trying to achieve some of those in part.
That's, well, yeah.
But the HEC was trying to, I mean, it was trying to do that in the OEIB.
Yeah, but we didn't want to just insert another layer.
Well, this feels like we're inserting another layer.
Well, we're getting rid of the, I mean, you know, we're transfer. So, I mean, in effect, we're taking three boards and putting them into the HEC.
I believe the word is munging.
Into the HEC or into
the HEC.
But then we're sunsetting the HEC.
No, we're sunsetting the OEIB.
Am I right? In my mind, I'm hearkening back to some nice visuals that Ben Cannon showed us.
Right.
And I took comfort in that, because until I saw that PowerPoint, these pieces were all swirling as I lay awake at 3 in the morning. That put some context to it and gave me some comfort. And I'm still thinking that this is the verbal equivalent of, or close to the equivalent of what we saw there.
It is exactly so. With some statutory references thrown in.
Here and there.
Ben's documents in our materials, isn't it?
Yes, it's on it's in our OLIS file. Yes.
You think that will reassure me?
You know, I don't know if it will be sufficient, but I think it will help.
My colleague next to you is nodding his head strongly.
Rep Johnson.
If not, come talk to me.
Mr. Chair, maybe it would be helpful for the committee to have both the written text and the visual aid at the same time to be able to say, here's box B that melds into box C over here, and here's what I can see in statute where that actually calls that out and so forth. So, I see how that works, that kind of thing.
Oh, I see.
It's all Mr. Visual. I mean, maybe it's a guy thing, I don't know. But
Wednesday is show and tell, right?
But maybe that would help to help the committee to work through and see that. Because, again, as we talk about consolidation, you know, the consolidation view in 4061, I think, was recognizing that with some governance changes, that there would probably likely be some need for consolidation within the Chancellor's office, within the State Board, perhaps, and so forth. But not necessarily an entire remake of the universe. That wasn't necessarily in play at the time that 4061 was, you know, they were talking about it last February, I guess, or whenever it was, back in 12. So this is a leap, I mean, from the original topic about governance consolidation and so forth. So I can understand, you know, Rep. Greenlee's wondering about that, and I think, frankly, a lot are, too, about this is a large leap from where we initially kind of set off down this path. Not to say it's the bad move, but it's a
right.
Quantum leap from where we were in, I think, February 2012.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Yes, Rep. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It is, and I'm a newcomer. I was not involved in a lot of members of this committee, and we have a couple new committee members, and I understand it, and I'm going to try to follow through and support it. But members of this committee, and I was strongly opposed to it. I've always supported the PK-20 concept. But, you know, we got another whole part of this prenatal too, is going to be buttoned in here, too, under all this. And that really, you see the difficulty we're having in this, implementing something we've talked about in this building since I've been here is PK-20. But we're also, this guy's, it's going to be prenatal to 26 years old under this system.
Well, we're focusing on the last part of that.
Oh, I got both.
But
I'm in another committee.
Oh, right. That's right. Yes. Anyway, colleagues, so, you know, as I mentioned, we have a work group that's working on this. And I would, you know, I would like, my hope is that, you know, we will get a recommendation from that work group you know, in terms of, you know, the direction that we're headed. And, you know, if the people on that group, you know, who include, you know, many of the principals involved, you know, either board members or department heads, you know, from the entities that we're talking about, if they feel that it would be more effective for them to remain as separate entities, you know, as is current, then obviously, you know, we will take that recommendation to heart. You know, the goal here is to see if we can, you know, break down those proverbial silos and try to come up with, you know, a truly post-secondary system for Oregon, while at the same time allowing the creation of local boards to, you know, invigorate the work that's happening at the local universities. So that, I mean, that's the goal, and you know, we'll let you know how it's going.
My only fear is I don't believe the OUS has been working very effectively. I'm worried about creating a more giant enterprise that also doesn't work very effectively. I'm not sure we'd be ahead of the game, but I'm with you.
Okay. Thank you.
On this voyage, we'll take this voyage together.
Okay. Any other comments about this at this time? Okay, then. Before you leave, we have to actually vote.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, Rep. Johnson?
Do we need to adopt these amendments today?
We do, yes.
For what purpose? I mean, in terms that once they're on there, you know, we're not working them anymore.
Then we start amending the amendment.
Yeah, then we start. Yes. I hopefully it won't take 25 amendments the way it took for the Senate Bill 242, but we will certainly have many further amendments. So this would be just to let the world know that this is what we're working on right now.
So that caveat, I can move forward.
Yes. Anybody have any objections to our adopting these -2 amendments? Okay. Seeing none, the -2 amendments are adopted. Colleagues, with that, I'm going to close this work session on House Bill 3120. And colleagues, we are adjourned.